so much for coming. I just want to do a couple of preliminary announcements. We got to thank some people for pulling this together, or helping us pull this together. We want to thank Atlantis for helping us out. Also, our other sponsors. You see some banners around the room. Custom Computers, Security in General. CBS Bahamas, who we used to know as Commonwealth Building Supplies, and of course NMC Leasing. And if without them, it wouldn't be possible for us to present someone such as Dan. Before we get into the formal part of the evening, I'd like to call on George Borlandelli, one of our directors, to come up and give you a little bit of background on what the Nassau Institute is trying to accomplish. Thank you.
Stop it. After the joke. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks very much for supporting the Nassau Institute with your presence in one of our evenings of our annual program of speakers. Thanks very much to our speaker of the night, Dr. Mitchell. And the Nassau Institute is a non-political, non-partisan institute devoted to promoting the ideas of freedom. And in Bahamas, this issue is particularly important because of the relevance of the sector to the economy. 30% of GNP approximately is generated in the financial sector. And we hope that this discussion, the presentation by Dr. Mitchell and your questions afterwards will linger and promote more exchange of ideas. The Nassau Institute is a humble, small effort by Bahamians to promote the ideas of freedom, and all your support is always welcome. We have lots of plans, and as usual, as economists, we cannot escape from this, limited resources. I thank you once again for your presence here. I also want to thank the Nassau Institute for accepting me as a foreigner in their with them and helping me continue with something that's been very close to my heart since I was 20 years old. No matter where I go, I will continue. And I'm also very, very honored because next week I'm going to represent the Nassau Institute in the Economic Freedom of the World project in Rio de Janeiro, where people are going to meet. This project tries to measure the advance of economic freedom and freedom in general in different parts of the world and the effect of those changes in economic and social prosperity. So, good evening again. Hope you enjoyed this presentation and the ensuing exchange of ideas. And thanks for your support.
I forgot to mention, in making this announcement, I'd like to mention that Sid Sweeting, one of our directors, is here. Peter Young in the back of the room, also one of our directors, is here. And I, at the same time, I'd like to bring apologies from our president, Joan Thompson, some extenuating circumstances. She couldn't make it this evening, but she wanted to let you know that you were in our thoughts and thank you. She wanted to thank you for coming. It's now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Daniel J. Mitchell. Dr. Mitchell is a top expert on tax reform and supply-side tax policy. He's a strong advocate of the flat tax, as seen on the table. He has copies of his book, recent book, The Global Tax Revolution. Prior to joining Cato, the Cato Institute, He was a senior fellow with the Heritage Foundation, an economist for Senator Bob Packwood and the Senate Finance Committee. He also served on the 88 Bush-Quayle transition team and was director of tax and budget policy for Citizens for a Sound Economy. His articles can be found in such publications as the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Investor's Business Daily, the Washington Times. He's a frequent guest on lots of radio and newspapers. If you Google or on YouTube, if you put Dan Mitchell in, lots of interesting stuff pops up, and I recommend you do that. He holds a bachelor's and master's degree in economics from the University of Georgia, hence his bulldog tie, and he has a PhD in economics from George Mason University. And one more apology, the projector and screen people didn't show up, so Dr. Mitchell has agreed to wing it, and I think you'll be all right at that. Please welcome Dr. Dan Mitchell.
Well, thank you very much, Rick. Don't worry. When the food comes, just start eating, because I grew up in New York. I talk loud, so I won't have any challenge with that. Although I'm very disappointed, Rick brought up a sore subject. My beloved Bulldogs lost to Florida last weekend, and I'm still going through the grieving process. I didn't really care who won the election. I did care who won the Georgia-Florida game. You have to have priorities in life. We don't have the PowerPoint projector, but in some sense that doesn't matter. I had a couple of graphs that may have been interesting to look at, but I'll make sure that Rick has the file, and if anybody wants to see those exciting graphs, I say that advisedly. You're certainly welcome. Maybe Rick can put it on the website or something like that. But what I want to talk about is why tax havens are a blessing. And given what's happened in the world in the last 10 years, with the OECD attacking low-tax jurisdictions, with the European Commission targeting low-tax jurisdictions, even the United Nations and to some extent the World Bank and the IMF, it seems that if you have an international bureaucracy out there, I forgot FATF and IOSCO. If there's an international bureaucracy, somehow they've decided that all the evils of the world are due to low-tax jurisdictions. And interestingly enough, they never seem to bother explaining why exactly that's true. And I think one of the reasons is because they simply don't have the evidence. Let's go ahead and walk through what the various threats are from around the world. I assume everyone in this room is familiar with the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. They really got the ball rolling in the mid-1990s, acting at the behest of some of the high-tax nations that were worried about competition from the so-called offshore world. They decided to launch a harmful tax competition project. Now, as an economist, when I first heard about this, I admit I was a little bit puzzled. Wait, competition is harmful? We like it when banks compete with each other. We like it when grocery stores compete with each other. We like it when pet stores compete with each other, when gas stations compete with each other, because we sort of learned, both in Economics 101 and just through real-life experience, that competition is good. When there's one gas station in the town, what do you get? High prices, shoddy service, inconvenient hours. But when there are five gas stations in a town, all of a sudden the consumer is the king, because you get to choose which gas station offers you the best package of attention and service and price. Well, the same thing is true for governments. When you have governments acting as monopolists, treating taxpayers as if they're captive customers, guess what? They're much less sensitive to what happens. So the whole OECD project immediately rubbed me the wrong way. And obviously, if you read the details from the OECD's 1998 and 2000 reports, you can see a mentality enshrined inside the OECD that was all about protecting and preserving the interests of high-tax governments and not anything grounded in good economics or sound policy. But the OECD is just one of the bureaucracies that we have to worry about. The European Commission launched something known as the Savings Tax Directive. Now, over the years, they've had a whole bunch of different anti-tax competition efforts, but the European Union Savings Tax Directive was the first one that, in effect, had a component of fiscal imperialism because they wanted other countries to participate in their cartel. Now, the Bahamas wasn't targeted by that, but all the territories of the United Kingdom and the Netherlands were targeted. And, as we're going to get into a little bit later, the European Union Savings Tax Directive was just part one. They have a sequel. And just like when Hollywood has a sequel, it's usually worse than the original. Well, the same thing is true for the European Union Savings Tax Directive. And then I mentioned there are other international bureaucracies like the Financial Action Task Force, United Nations, but we don't really need to worry about them right now. But it's not just the international bureaucracies. Unfortunately, I'm ashamed to say that the United States government may be the source of some headaches in the near future. We now have complete control by the Democrats of both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. And given that the Democrats, on average, are more interested in higher taxes than Republicans, now Republicans, God knows, they were big spenders during the last 8 years, but they like borrowing and spending. Democrats like tax and spending. I keep waiting for a party that doesn't like spending, but I'll probably be in my grave before that happens. But if you look at some of the initiatives that we're likely to see out of the Democrats in Congress, not to mention the fact that Senator Obama was a main sponsor of the Levin legislation and the Dorgan legislation, both of which blacklist the Bahamas, I do worry that, you know, set aside all other issues that we may care about, if we're just focusing on tax competition, this may not be a positive development. And then, of course, we have a wild card, the financial crisis. Now, at least in the U.S., this was completely home-brewed. We made it ourselves. We caused it ourselves with easy money policy from the Federal Reserve, corrupt system of housing subsidies from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, two government institutions, and then all sorts of other government policies that were designed to, in effect, force home loans on everybody, even if they weren't very creditworthy. We created a bubble through these bad government policies. The bubble has burst. The interlinkage of financial markets around the world has meant, and in addition to housing bubbles in places like the UK and Ireland and Spain and other places, we now have a worldwide financial turmoil. And what do you know? President Sarkozy of France has decided somehow this is the fault of tax havens. Now, no one's ever bothered to ask Sarkozy, well, exactly how did tax havens cause this? It's sort of like when you had the Asian financial crisis 10 years ago. That was the fault of tax havens. Now, again, no one ever bothered to point out or even make the most elementary case for why this was the case. But in some sense, as someone who's been involved in the policy and the political world for more than 20 years, I have to admire the other side. I mean, if there was an outbreak of cavities, they would probably blame that on tax havens. And since most gullible reporters just go completely along with it, you wind up getting these stories. And when we're talking about the threats that places like the Bahamas will face, we had this International Emergency Economic Summit on November 15th. And God knows what sort of plans are going to hatch there, but we already know that the IMF, which is constantly in search of a new mission in life since we don't have fixed exchange rates, the role of a global financial regulator is something that makes them salivate. And again, who would control that global financial regulatory architecture? The high-tax countries that don't like low-tax jurisdictions like the Bahamas. So lots of things we have to worry about out there. Now, let me go ahead and back up for a second and be a boring economist and explain the role of tax competition and tax havens and economic policy around the world. This battle exists because globalization is driving governments to make tax policy better. When you have globalization, jobs and capital can flow across national borders in a much easier fashion. And what does this mean? What does labor and capital want? Labor and capital want the highest possible after-tax return. And so if you have a choice, two otherwise equal investments, one in France, one in the Bahamas, guess who's going to win out? The Bahamas, because you have a much better tax system. By the way, would anybody want to trade? We'll give you the IRS. You give us your tax system? No. I've been asking that all day long, and nobody's taking me up on that offer. But because we have a world with many different tax policies in many different jurisdictions, and because globalization has dramatically reduced the cost of cross-border economic activity, we are getting all sorts of good policy reforms around the world. And let me just run through them. And we'll start with 1980, because 1980 is really when this ball got rolling, because you had Thatcher and Reagan both coming into office and both dramatically reducing tax rates. The top tax rate, and it's sometimes stunning to think that you actually had countries with policies like this, but the top tax rate in the UK used to be 83%. And that's just personal income tax. You had other forms of double taxation, so your effective marginal tax rate actually could approach 100%. In Sweden, it actually was over 100%. The U.S. top tax rate, we were like a free market paradise compared to the U.K. We were only 70%. Well, Thatcher and Reagan came into office, looked at the economic wreckage caused by big government, and they said, we're going to slash tax rates. The top tax rate in the U.K. went from 83 down to 40, and the U.S. went from 70 down to 28. But I'm not here to talk about the beneficial impact of that on the U.K. and the U.S. economies. What was fascinating is that the Thatcher and Reagan tax rate reductions triggered a worldwide revolution of lower tax rates. And if you look at top tax rates in OECD countries today, with where they were back in 1980, the average reduction was 26 percentage points. In other words, it wasn't just Reagan and Thatcher, two free market ideologues who cut tax rates. Every single OECD government cut tax rates, not because they wanted to, though. They only cut tax rates because of the pressure of tax competition. The same thing is true for corporate tax rates. Go back to 1980, the average corporate tax rate was 48%. Now it's down under 27%. And what's really ironic about this, the U.S. used to be the leader in cutting tax rates. We cut our tax rates dramatically under Reagan, but then we've left them there ever since the 1980s. And now we have the second highest corporate tax rate in the developed world. So it just shows that you can start the ball rolling on tax competition, but if you don't continue to be in the race, you're going to fall behind. And then most fascinating to me as a tax reformer, when I first got to Washington, there were only three flat tax jurisdictions. Now there are 25. Now, ironically, usually when I'm talking about this, I tell the audience, and isn't it great, these flat tax jurisdictions? When I'm here in the Bahamas, I say, don't do a flat tax. Keep with zero as your tax rate. The last thing the Bahamas should ever do is adopt an income tax. And what's fascinating is if you look at this flat tax revolution around the world, of the 25 jurisdictions with flat taxes, 18 of them are in the former communist world. So it's really amazing, even though they were subject to decades of class warfare propaganda, we should hate the rich and tax the rich and confiscate all the money from the rich, the moment they became free, many of these jurisdictions said, the heck with communist and socialist philosophy. We suffered for decades under that policy. We want to have a policy that attracts job creation. We want policies that attract wealth creation. And so all these former communist countries are throwing Karl Marx in the dustbin, and they're taking Milton Friedman off the shelves, and they're designing tax systems that are much less punitive to private sector wealth creation. Now, obviously, we're just talking about policy here. What really matters at the end of the day is results. And I think if you, let's just take the 30,000 foot look. If you look at what economic performance was in OECD countries during the 1960s and 1970s, when they were spiraling down into stagnation and stagflation, and then look what's happened to the global economy since tax competition began to force better results, there's no question that tax competition has led to better policy and better results. And this is important because you have the OECD saying tax competition is harmful. But again, what I say over and over again, every time I run into my, quote, good friend, unquote, Jeffrey Owens at the OECD, I say, Jeffrey, have you come up with any evidence yet that tax competition is harmful? He sort of just tries to run away. But the world is a laboratory. And that laboratory is showing that the nations with more free market policy, the nations with lower tax rates, those are the ones that are growing faster, creating more jobs, offering more opportunity to their peoples. And one thing that you're going to miss because we don't have the PowerPoint is I had several slides showing and comparing countries that were going in the free market direction and countries that were going in the other direction. So you're missing a chart showing Estonia skyrocketing because they're the biggest free market reformer. You're missing a chart showing Venezuela on a 30-year decline and Chile on a 30-year upward trajectory. What's the difference? One country's going with free markets and prospering. One country's going with more collectivism and statism, and their people are suffering. You're missing a good chart, Ireland compared to France. And we Americans love to pick on the French. Matter of fact, I was on eBay the other day, and I found a great ad, French military rifles for sale, hardly used, only dropped once. And of course, I love comparing Ireland and France because, you know, I guess 130 years ago or something, some of my ancestors came over from Ireland to help build the New York City subways, which, of course, are now government-run monopoly and not very efficient, so maybe they should have stayed in Ireland after all. So what's really going on? We have all this empirical evidence. We have all the academic research showing that tax competition is beneficial, that tax competition is leading to more growth, more jobs, more prosperity. Well, of course, I don't need to tell people in this room what's really going on is that the politicians from high tax countries want more revenue. It's that simple. And when they see low tax jurisdictions, especially with a good financial services sector that are attracting the capital, the politicians know that that's a threat to them. It's a threat to them because it's harder to collect more money and politicians buy votes by having more revenue in their treasuries. But it's also a threat to them because they can't play class warfare economics. Every time France and Germany have been forced to cut tax rates by tax competition, most recently Germany cut their corporate tax rate from 39% down to 30%. They do it with gritted teeth and with just pain and anguish. They hate having to cut tax rates, but tax competition is forcing them to do it, and they would love to figure out some way to get out of the box that tax competition puts them in, and that's why they're such big supporters of the OECD and European Union efforts to try to thwart tax competition. Now, interestingly, and this is, again, another area where I wish I could put this stuff on screen, I have all these quotes from Nobel Prize-winning economist George Stigler, who said competition among communities and governments offers not obstacles but opportunities to choose the type and scale of government functions they wish. Gary Becker saying competition among nations tends to produce a race to the top rather than to the bottom. James Buchanan, tax competition is an objective to be sought in its own right. Milton Friedman, competition among national governments in the public services they provide and in the taxes they impose is every bit as productive as competition in the private sector. More quotes from Vernon Smith, Edward Prescott, Edmund Phelps. I'm not going to go through all these quotes. Rick will have them all for you, I'm sure. But you have on one side of this debate the Nobel Prize-winning economist, the real-world evidence of tax rates and economic growth, all the academic research, and on the other side, you have Sarkozy and Merkel and various IRSs around the world that are just greedy for more revenue. So the facts are on our side. Economic growth, economic vitality, productive economies are the results of our policies, and the question is, will we get dragged back to the 1960s and the 1970s if the OECD is successful in creating a global tax cartel? And what's fascinating about looking at the OECD is it's actually a multi-headed beast. It's the Committee on Fiscal Affairs at the OECD, which is comprised of representatives from the tax police of each member country. That's the part of the OECD that's doing the bad work. If you look at the OECD's economists that work for the General Secretariat, what are they writing? Well, OECD economists have written that, quote, the ability to choose the location of economic activity offsets shortcomings in government budgeting processes, limiting a tendency to tax and spend excessively, unquote. So in other words, even the OECD economists realize that tax competition is a vital and important check on the tendency of governments to be too greedy. But the Committee on Fiscal Affairs, a bunch of tax pleas in a room with blinders on, have decided they should be able to remake the world in their own vision. And here's another OECD study found that, quote, legal tax avoidance can be reduced by closing loopholes and illegal tax evasion can be contained by better enforcement of tax codes. But the root of the problem appears in many cases to be high tax rates. So in other words, if the OECD really wanted to try to shut down the financial services sector in the Bahamas, they could fix their own tax systems. But they don't want to do that. They're like the inefficient monopoly gas station that's unhappy that new gas stations have come to town and are offering better prices and better service to consumers. And they want to figure out some way to, in effect, use the coercive power of government to shut down the new gas stations. That is economically wrong, and it's morally wrong. And actually, speaking of moral, I want to make the case that tax competition and tax havens is not just an economic issue. It's also a moral issue. The majority of the world's nations do not respect human rights. The majority of the world's nations do not have good rule of law. a majority of the world's nations in some form or fashion persecute people based on ethnicity, religion, politics. And so, you know, whether you look at the Freedom House list of countries that still have oppression, whether you look at the World Bank's governance indicators, there are all these measures out there showing that in many countries around the world, to be successful, especially if you're some kind of ethnic, racial, or religious minority, is oftentimes a very, very dangerous thing. And it, sometimes you might not even need a venal government. You might just have an incompetent government. Let's look at the case of Venezuela, even before Hugo Chavez. When you have corruption in the tax office and you're a successful entrepreneur and bureaucrats in the tax office will sell your information to kidnapping gangs, and the next thing you know, you get one of your kids' fingers in the mail with a ransom note, you would be crazy to keep your money in a local bank and report it to a tax authority. You have to put the safety of your family before the law when the law is improperly administered, incompetently administered, or venally administered, or if the rule of law simply does not exist at all. Or let's take a real-world case from just the recent headlines. Argentina recently stole, there's no other word to describe it, recently stole the pension assets of the Argentinian people. Now, and by the way, this is on top of the fact that a number of years ago, they half stole the assets of the Argentinian savers and investors by devaluing the currency. So if you're an Argentinian and you're trying to build a better life for your family, you want to keep your money in an Argentinian bank with an incompetent and venal government, or do you put your money in the Bahamas or Miami or Cayman or some other place? Because, by the way, what's interesting, one of the interesting features of this whole OECD issue is that many OECD nations themselves are tax havens. So there's a big element of hypocrisy here. The UK, the US, Netherlands, Austria, Belgium, Switzerland, Luxembourg, 80% of the world's so-called offshore assets are in onshore nations. And yet, what is the OECD doing? It's picking on the smaller, less powerful jurisdictions. So in some sense, you know, that's an economic issue, but it's also a moral issue. Just the inherent offensiveness of a bunch of hypocrites who, by the way, get tax-free salaries. So you have these bureaucrats sitting in Paris with tax-free salaries trying to persecute smaller and developing nations who are trying to compete against all the tax havens in the OECD world. Something smells about that whole thing. And so when you have tax havens serving as a refuge for people, not just from economic oppression, but from all the other types of oppression that either venal or incompetent governments can impose, why on earth would we want to risk and create more danger by trying to stamp out financial privacy around the world? And by the way, this has nothing to do with money laundering. If you look at the academic evidence, money gets laundered where criminal loot is obtained. And where is criminal loot obtained? It's overwhelmingly from the drug trade in OECD countries, especially the U.S. 50% of the world's money laundering, according to the FBI, takes place in the U.S. And even the United Nations, which is on the other side with the OECD on these issues, even the U.N. admits that money launderers very, very rarely try to move their countries across their money across borders because it raises a red flag and a paper trail, or at least an electronic paper trail, for investigators. Now, what's interesting, just as you have OECD economists admitting that tax competition is good from an economic perspective, we have some people on the other side who have been forced to make a few admissions about the moral case for tax havens. Jeffrey Owens, my good, good friend, he was quoted by the UK Observer saying, "Owens stressed that tax havens are essential for individuals who live in unstable regimes." Now, his definition of unstable regimes is probably a lot more restrictive than mine. I would put about 99% of the world's countries in that. He might only put 50% of the world's countries in that. Joe Guttentag, he was International Tax Counsel under Bill Clinton back when the U.S. was in favor of the OECD. And I was actually on a panel with him, which is why I had this quote. And Guttentag was forced to admit under my relentless badgering, I'm good at that, I'm coming from New York, he said, "How far do we want to go with this information exchange and the secrecy issues, the privacy issues, and so forth, which relates to the problems of corrupt governments of danger to your children and to individuals?" And then, last but not least, the UN, probably my least favorite international bureaucracy. They had a report in 1998 that, of course, was attacking places like the Bahamas, but even the UN was forced to confess, quote, for much of the 20th century, governments around the world spied on their citizens to maintain political control. Political freedom can depend on the ability to hide purely personal information from government. Let's not forget, why are the Swiss financial privacy laws so strong? Why do they have such a good human rights policy on privacy? Because they reformed their laws and strengthened them in the 1930s to protect German Jews who are trying to hide their money from the Nazis. Well, I have no idea what we're going to see in the future. I hope we never see something as repulsive as what the Nazis tried to do. But governments around the world historically have always been the greatest source of oppression. And so for economic reasons, I love tax havens, but also as a check on the power, the corruption, the venality, and the incompetence of governments, we also need tax havens for those reasons. Well, let's go ahead and look at what all this means and where we're going, and then I'll go ahead and shut up so you all can actually eat the rest of your dinner here. First, the reasons for optimism. Number one, the terms of the debate have changed. If you look at the OECD's website, a number of years ago, they actually stopped using the term harmful tax competition. We sort of embarrassed them out of doing that, and now they just refer to harmful tax practices. And they're even being forced to say, we like tax competition, but we like fair tax competition. It's sort of like protectionists are embarrassed to be protectionists, so they're in favor of fair trade. Well, at least they're, even though we know the leopard spots haven't changed, at least we're forcing the leopard to pretend it's not the evil predator that it once was. So at least if we had them on the defensive, that's something. Might not mean much at the end of the day, but at least it's an improvement. We also have, I think, a lot of mileage to be gained with the moral argument. If Jeffrey Owens is forced to admit that tax havens are valuable as a refuge against oppression, then we know that that has to be something that makes him very uncomfortable. And likewise, I think the media is somewhat sympathetic to that argument on the moral basis. And also, I have found over the years, most journalists tend to be left of center, but when you present them with the evidence, this is when tax competition started, this is how tax rates fell, these are the positive economic results, even journalists, they sort of scratch their head, and I don't think we ever get them on our side, but they recognize that there's a real argument there, and I always ask the journalist, has the OECD ever shown you the evidence for why tax competition is harmful? And they always say, well, no. I say, well, keep asking. Maybe someday, some year, they'll actually provide that. And then perhaps most important, as tax competition continues, more and more countries are cutting tax rates. More and more countries are adopting flat taxes. At some point, I hope, we're going to reach a tipping point. Because when the OECD launched this project back in the mid-1990s, almost all OECD nations were high-tax countries. Well, now, every one of those OECD nations has to some degree cut taxes, and some of them have cut tax rates an awful lot and reformed their tax systems. Those countries that have made those reforms are no longer suffering the big outflows of jobs and capital. So they no longer have an incentive to side with Germany and France. As a matter of fact, if the OECD tried to take the vote today that they took in 1998 that launched this entire project, I suspect that they would lose. Now, Switzerland and Luxembourg made a giant mistake in 1998. They abstained. They could have killed the project right then and there. But if they took the vote again today, I think Switzerland and Luxembourg would feel comfortable voting no, as well as several other OECD countries would probably vote no as well. So in some sense, it's very unfortunate that we're not in that position again. The OECD claims that that one vote back in 1998 gives them carte blanche to do whatever they want into the future indefinitely. And there's probably no way we can change that. Now, those were the reasons for optimism. Here are the reasons for pessimism. The expanded Democrat control of Congress means that there's going to be a lot more philosophical interest in persecuting low-tax jurisdictions just because Democrats, like, as I said before, they're the tax and spend party. The Republicans are the borrow and spend party. Again, there's no good party out there. But because they're the tax and spend party, they're much more philosophically sympathetic to the OECD. It's not just the Levin Obama legislation and the Dorgan Obama legislation. There are lots of other bills out there targeting various elements of the offshore world, whether it's anti-hedge fund legislation, anti-Bermuda and Switzerland reinsurance company legislation. There's a whole panoply of bad bills that now have a big lease on life as a result of the election. And as I mentioned before, Obama is a sponsor of some of these bad pieces of legislation. Now, I've worked in the Senate before, and so just because Obama is a sponsor of bad legislation doesn't mean he actually cares about it. When I worked for Senator Packwood of Oregon, I would oftentimes sort of run something under his nose. Hey, here's a bill that you should sponsor. Oh, okay. And I'd sign him onto things that I thought were good bills. So I'm hoping that Obama himself doesn't actually have any animus against places like the Bahamas. He just had some very left-wing staffer that wanted him to sign onto these bills. However, you saw, I assume, during the campaign that he used some anti-tax haven rhetoric. Now, during campaigns, politicians oftentimes say things that they don't believe at all. And think back to 2000, George Bush said he wanted smaller government. He obviously didn't believe that at all. So I'm hoping that Senator Obama, President-elect Obama, doesn't really have the hostility to low-tax jurisdictions that the legislation implies and that some of the campaign rhetoric implies. But it would be smart for all of us to at least be prepared for the fact that he may have been serious, or that even if he wasn't serious, that his staff that he appoints will decide to go forward and attack and persecute low-tax jurisdictions. And then in the long run, the thing that we have to worry about perhaps the most are the demographic changes in Europe and to some extent in the U.S. Right now, European nations are on the cusp. They already have very bad demographic profiles in terms of the number of taxpayers versus the number of tax consumers. When you have a society where 30% of the people are carrying the load for 70% of the people, that's not good news. But the European nations are on the cusp of having their baby boom generations retire. And when you move into a situation where every worker has their own personal retiree strapped on their back, not to mention everything else government wants to do to tax and spend and redistribute to try to buy political votes, that's going to create enormous pressure for even bigger government, which means that the politicians in OECD countries are going to be even greedier to track down every possible penny that wants to leave the country. And so I think that over time, we're going to get even more and more pressure. So what does that mean for the OECD? Well, the good news is that for much of this decade, the OECD agenda was stalemated. It was stalemated in part because as bad as George Bush was, and I never voted for him, at least we were able to pressure him to not be in bed with the French and the Germans at the OECD. And without U.S. support, the OECD agenda sort of stalled out. Not only that, but I think the low-tax jurisdictions were very smart, and the Bahamas was one of the leaders in this. They were pretty smart in insisting on what were called the level playing field clauses. Well, wait, you want us to slit our wrists by agreeing to these bad policies? Okay, well, we'll agree to slit our wrists, but only if OECD countries agree to slit their wrists as well. And of course, everyone knew that Switzerland and Luxembourg and the U.S. and the other jurisdictions with tax haven policies weren't going to do it. And so the level playing field clause created an additional stalemate. Unfortunately, every bit of evidence we have is that the OECD is about to say, to heck with level playing field, we're going to create a new blacklist, and the blacklist is going to be based not on whether you've made a commitment, but on how many TIEAs, how many tax information exchange agreements you sign. And I don't know, I have to confess, I don't know, does that mean 5, does that mean 10, but that's the direction the OECD clearly is heading in. And of course, we also have the European Commission, which already has announced that they want to take the current EU savings tax directive and they want to dramatically expand it. They want to expand it in terms of the number of financial instruments it covers, and they want to expand it in terms of the number of countries that it covers. So it used to be that they originally asked for only 6 non-OECD countries to be part of it, including Switzerland and the United States. The U.S. said no. Switzerland said yes, but only if you completely eviscerate it, so it's like Swiss cheese. No pun intended there. And then, of course, they had the little principalities like Liechtenstein and Monaco that were part of it. But now the OECD says, we want all the other financial, not the OECD, the European Commission is saying, we want all the other financial centers in the world to be part of this savings tax cartel, including Hong Kong, including Singapore, including Panama, including the Bahamas. And so along with all the hassling that you're going to get from the bureaucrats in Paris, you're now going to get some additional nagging and pestering from the bureaucrats in Brussels. By the way, the bureaucrats in Brussels at least do pay tax to the European Union. So, I don't know, that doesn't stop them from being bad, but at least they're not quite as hypocritical. Now, what does this mean in terms of a strategy for the Bahamas? And I'll go ahead and close on this. As I have said from the very beginning on this issue, the low-tax jurisdictions need to unite together in terms of a common strategy. Now, this is a challenge. It's a challenge because you're used to competing with each other. It's also a challenge because your political situations are not all identical. Some of the low-tax jurisdictions that are being persecuted are UK and Dutch territories. And obviously, at the end of the day, they are somewhat constrained in what they can say and what they can do. But there's also a challenge in that some jurisdictions have decided, and we already see this with like the Isle of Man, the Channel Islands, that, well, okay, we'll go ahead and throw our private client business overboard and sign these TIEAs and focus more on institutional clients. And so if you wind up, and then of course, once they do that, then they have an incentive to actually say to the OECD, you need to go after the Bahamas because they're not signing these TIEAs. That natural competition between jurisdictions could actually be a negative thing in that case. So I'm not quite sure how much of a common united approach the low-tax jurisdictions can have, but ideally it should be there. It's also important, even though the OECD is about to say the level playing field doesn't matter and to heck with whether Switzerland and Delaware are tax havens, we still want to force you little guys to sign up. Even if the OECD does that, it's still an embarrassing strategy for them to follow. Because even if journalists are left-leaning, they still recognize gross and glaring hypocrisy when they see it. And so for the low-tax jurisdictions to say, okay, well, we'll sign the same amount of TIEAs that Delaware signs, that Switzerland signs, that Luxembourg signs, that Singapore signs, that is probably an effective strategy to at least some extent. And then at the end of the day, this is the same strategy I had about taking out the trash when I was married. Just delay, delay, delay. Say nice words, but do as little as possible. Because with any hope, whatever rejuvenated intensity the OECD and the European Commission bring out in 2009, it's difficult to maintain that. And hopefully something will happen that will distract them, that will get them moving in other directions. And yes, they'll always have some bureaucrats whose main job will be to try to bully the low-tax jurisdictions. But go to conferences with them year after year. Let the OECD have a million global forums, and low-tax jurisdictions can go to those and nod their heads and smile and be polite and have wonderful conversation over cocktails. But at the end of the day, if you keep delaying, tax competition will continue to thrive, and more OECD countries will cut their tax rates. And the more OECD countries that cut their tax rates, the smaller coalition of OECD countries that will exist that want to pursue the anti-tax competition project. So with that, I do have an Adam Smith quote that I was going to put up on the PowerPoint screen. But again, it's a great quote because 230-something years ago, Adam Smith, in effect, foresaw the exact issue that we're dealing with now and how capital should be allowed to flow freely around the world, and that governments that try to overtax it are going to lose it, and that this is a good thing. So once again, I'll go ahead and say, for people who want these great quotes from Nobel Prize winners and from the father of economics, first of all, feel free to give me your card, and I'll be happy to send you lots of additional information. But Rick also will have the presentation for your viewing pleasure. Thank you very much. And I suppose I'm going to answer questions and stuff like that. So continue eating. As you heard, I'm plenty loud. But just ask questions, and I'll continue answering until Rick somehow tells me, shut up, we've done enough. Yes.
One question for you. That was, here you're preaching inverted in many ways. But what do you think is going to happen in the Bahamas?
Well, I'm certainly probably the last person in this room to have any special insight into the political mind of the leaders here in the Bahamas. So in some sense, I'm going to dodge your question. I sound like a politician. I am going to meet with some of the officials here, and I'm certainly going to give them a lot of the same message that I've talked about here, especially to utilize the level playing field argument to try to find a common strategy with other low-tax jurisdictions. But I assume they already know that anyhow, so it's not like I'm going to have any great and special insight for them. Yes, sir.
Just following on with that point made, the smaller countries really have a very difficult time trying to stand up to the OECD. We've always prided ourselves in our own sort of jurisdiction. You see it as being beneficial for the low tax jurisdictions to get together as a common group, as opposed to individual people. I may go back to one point. You made many very valid points. But there was no reference made to when these high-tax countries reduced their taxes, that their revenue actually increased. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, I'll take those in reverse order and start with your last point first. I do have, in some of the presentations I give, I have charts showing OECD country tax rates going down once tax competition got going, but then other charts showing that OECD tax revenues are going up. Even if you measure it as a share of GDP, tax revenues have been very, very robust. I don't like to say healthy because I don't like governments having a lot of tax revenue, but the point is that we've had what are called Laffer curve effects. And by the way, when Rick mentioned going onto YouTube, I have a three-part series on YouTube about the theoretical Laffer curve, the actual real-world evidence of the Laffer curve, and then how governments should do revenue estimating. Because in the U.S., and actually this goes back when I worked for Senator Packwood, we sent a letter to our revenue estimators, which are called the Joint Committee on Taxation, and we asked them, how much money would the government collect if we levied a 100% tax rate on all income over $200,000 a year? So the Joint Committee on Taxation sent back a letter on, I don't remember the specific number, so I'll just make them up here, that you'll collect $200 billion the first year, $216 billion the second year, $235 billion the third year, so on and so forth. So we crafted a follow-up letter to the bureaucrats, basically saying, so you're saying that if the government steals every penny someone makes over $200,000 a year, they're going to continue earning more than $200,000 a year and continue paying that 100% tax rate. Could you please reconsider the issue? So the Joint Committee on Taxation sends another letter back to the senator. What does it show? The first year, $200 billion. The second year, $216 billion. Third year, $235 billion, and so on. But this time they had an asterisk. And the asterisk said, our models assume that tax has no impact on the economy and on individual behavior. Now, of course, in the real world, that is probably the stupidest thing that anyone could possibly imagine, because we know in the real world that tax has an impact on behavior. And certainly we know, looking at OECD countries, that the ones that have cut their tax rates have dramatically increased revenue in many cases, but certainly they have not suffered big losses in revenue at all, or little losses in revenue. So on that issue, yes, I mean, the evidence is on our side, but for some reason, we can't get governments to believe it. It's sort of like they think, okay, well, we got lucky. We cut tax rates and the revenue stayed up. But somehow we're going to have to raise taxes in the future when all our baby boomers retire, and so we want to collect more money. I wish I knew the great answer to that, because I banged my head against the wall dealing with that issue in Washington. Now, on the issue of low-tax jurisdictions cooperating, there already is an organization called the International Tax and Investment Organization. I know several low-tax jurisdictions are members of it. I don't pretend to know how effective they are and how much actual cooperation takes place. I do know that the OECD has global forums that the low-tax jurisdictions meet and caucus together and try to plan out what their reaction is going to be. Again, I don't know how successful that is. I know that I always go to these global forums and the Center for Freedom and Prosperity, which I'm on the board of. We always hold these counter conferences where we bring in the local academics from the local free market community and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, you know, how much cooperation the low-tax jurisdictions can have amongst each other, that's going to be up to the different governments. I hope a lot, because I think that's important and effective. I should say one other thing about the Bahamas and the strategy of the Bahamas. At the end of the day, what is the stick that the OECD has to beat you with? The stick is the threat that you'll be cut off from the global financial system, especially cut off from a United States banks and United States clearing operations and stuff like that. In some sense, you're protected because you already decided to make peace with the 800-pound gorilla of the U.S. by signing a TIEA. So at the end of the day, the real threat to the Bahamas that you have to calculate is to what extent would an Obama administration, or more relevantly, some of the bureaucrats under him, to what extent are they so just viscerally hostile to good tax policy that they'll go ahead and threaten to blacklist the Bahamas and sanction you and cut you off from our financial system simply because you haven't signed a TIA with France. Now, if Larry Summers is the Treasury Secretary, that's a big danger because he is evil incarnate on this issue. On the other hand, you could have a Treasury Secretary that doesn't think this is an important issue at all, and no matter how much the OECD cries and stamps its feet, you're going to be protected because you won't lose any access whatsoever to the U.S. financial system. But we just don't know the answer to those questions yet. So, sorry for the long-winded answer, but several important things to cover. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Yeah. I'd like to raise a question about whether the Bahamas and countries like us are really low-tax jurisdictions. Admittedly, we don't have any income tax. So we always think in terms of income tax. But if some clever economist, mathematician, looked at the total tax burden, that is, we live on import duties, include them in tax burden. We have all kinds of internal transaction taxes, property taxes, business license taxes, hotel taxes. If there was some way to combine all that tax burden, I'm not so sure we would come out as a low-tax jurisdiction. And I think there are other countries very much like us, which for various reasons don't have the willpower or perhaps the ability to collect income tax, but still impose on the economy a huge tax burden through other kinds of taxes. I just raise that question.
You know,
this is coming into your thinking.
Yes, no, that's a great point, because if you look at the data and you look at government spending and government revenues as a share of GDP, it's not as if there's no tax in Bahamas or Cayman or stuff like that. You usually find in these jurisdictions with no income tax, government spending and taxes of about 20% of GDP. Now, that's not a minimal state. That's 20% of GDP. That's a lot bigger than the size of government for much of U.S. history in America.
Right.
And it's bigger than the size of government as a share of GDP in places like Hong Kong that do have an income tax. So what's really happening here, it's not so much an attack against low-tax or no-tax jurisdictions. It's an attack against jurisdictions that have chosen a better approach of raising revenue. Because no tax is good for an economy, but some taxes have a much more negative effect on the economy. Income taxes and corporate income taxes, the personal and corporate taxes, are by far the worst taxes for an economy. And if you then look inside personal and corporate income taxes, the double taxation of capital, things like capital gains taxes and death taxes and wealth taxes, tend to be the most damaging. So income taxes are damaging, and then inside income taxes are some super damaging taxes, whereas consumption-based taxes, such as excise taxes, import taxes, and sales taxes, tend to be much less destructive to an economy. So in effect, if you really break down what the OECD is trying to do, is they're trying to create a one-size-fits-all policy for the world where countries will inevitably be driven to the very worst type of tax system. What is the OECD trying to do? It's trying to tax on an extraterritorial basis, and it's trying to double tax income that's saved and invested. Well, those are the very worst features of the current income tax. And if you do like a pure Haur-Rabushka-style flat tax, you get rid of all those things. So again, that just calls back the previous point, that if a country in the OECD world actually adopted good tax policy, the whole issue of tax evasion would disappear. Even IMF economists, there's a guy, Friedrich Schneider, at the University of Johannes Kepler University in Linz, Austria. He is the world's expert on this. He's written about this for the World Bank and stuff like that. He says tax evasion unquestionably is linked to tax rates. You want to reduce tax evasion, much as the OECD economists, I also cite it, say, lower tax rates. It's that simple. If you try to shut down the offshore world, maybe the OECD will win this battle. The Bahamas will go back to being a very poor country, serving pina coladas to tourists. That would be a terrible thing. But will that get more revenue for OECD governments? No, because money will just be underground in some other form or fashion. Or people will decide, I'm not going to work 60 hours a week to build this business. I'm going to work 40 hours a week and live a decent life because it's not worth trying to become more productive and more rich because the government's going to seize too much of it. So at the end of the day, the OECD is following a very self-defeating strategy. Because at the end of the day, lower tax rates are really their economic hope for salvation, but they don't see it that way. The politicians want more money. And even if they're just buying another 10 years, because maybe if they defeat the offshore world, they'll buy another 10 years of revenue. But still, they're going to come to a point of collapse because governments are too big and there's no way of financing governments if you're going to have the government consume over half of your economy's output. So that's why, that's what makes me so frustrated about the American situation. My choice in this last election was borrow and spend versus tax and spend. Well, if America goes down that route, sooner or later, we're going to be just like France. And that's what I'm afraid of. I don't want the Bahamas to be forced like to be like France. I don't want America to be forced to be like France. If France wants to be France, God bless them. They're going to lose their productive people and their productive capital. But I don't want them to export their bad tax policy around the world. And that's what's going on right now. Yes, sir.
I wonder if you could say a few more words about the UK, Jersey, Guernsey. You mentioned that the new OECD, new initiative, tried to impose a TIEA on the territories. But in a way, is that the point? Because that is going to disclose or flush out it's legal to put your money there if you are a non-resident of the UK. It always amazes me that with the socialist governments in 1997, these territories have been allowed to continue. It's obviously what Gordon Brown, World Credit, would like that money, even belonging to UK non-residents, but UK citizens, he would like that money in the UK. So it's not the pressure, despite the TIEA, it's not the great pressure that they will be closed down completely.
Well, just as I gave the caveat that I don't pretend to have any great sense of what the Bahamian political leadership should do, it's not as if I have any great insight about what's really motivating Gordon Brown. I did find it interesting. Well, first, allow me to say that the offshore world has been very beneficial to the city of London. Much of the capital and the Channel Islands and places like that winds up getting funneled through London. London itself is a tax haven in many ways. And of course, London has always benefited immensely from the whole non-dom policy, where you bring in rich people around the world and they basically only have to pay tax on whatever they bring into the UK. So the UK has been one of the most successful offshore centers in a way in the world. And they're actually now considering killing the goose that's laying the golden egg with restrictions on the non-dom policy. And then if they wind up messing up things for the Channel Islands and the Isle of Man, that's going to further reduce the flows that wind up going through London. Now, part of this whole debate is we're obviously focusing on OECD countries. And currently, all the OECD cares about is the politicians want to line their own pockets with additional tax revenue. You still have all the rest of the world, Africa, Latin America, much of Asia. And so somehow if the OECD and the European Commission succeed in effect forcing the Bahamas to become vassal tax collectors, you'll still have business from these other parts of the world. But one thing that I think is very important to understand, once the OECD wins this battle, if they do, It's just been a matter of time before they come back and ask for more. And the OECD is expanding the 40 countries, including places like Brazil and South Africa. So you're going to have additional demands for information sharing from virtually every country in the world. So that's why when you have someone who completely wants, at the end of the day, to destroy you, it makes no sense to give in. It's like the analogy is, you know, giving Hitler the Sudetenland did not stop him from eventually wanting other parts, allowing him to to remilitarize the Rhineland or the Saar. I mean, as a typical American, my European history is a little bit shallow, but the fundamental notion of appeasing somebody who wants to destroy you, I think, is very relevant. And I think the OECD and the governments all around the world that had the same mentality as the bureaucrats of the OECD, once they win one battle, they're just going to come back and ask for more from you, and they come back and ask for more from you. You look at the academics who are on the side of the OECD and the type of stuff that they want with harmonized tax rates, not just global information sharing, you have to resist, because the moment you surrender on A, it simply accelerates when the OECD asks for B. And sooner or later, they're going to get to Z. Yes?
Okay. Academics defend an academic point of view, not a political point of view. A one type of system, taxing system for the whole world, when it's totally different taxing a growing economy, a poor economy, and a rich economy which has accumulated capital for a century. How can defend one for all?
Well, I'm certainly not going to bore this crowd with the lengthy explanation of it, but there is a theory known as capital export neutrality. And to sort of boil it down to its core essence, the theory assumes that you have a world with no taxes. And I like that theory. You know, some people dream about worlds with supermodels. I dream about worlds with no taxes. So if you hypothesize a world with no taxes, what do economists say? Economists say that resources in that world will be allocated on the basis of economic efficiency. And that's right. There are no taxes to distort people's decision-making. And then you say, well, let's now take this no-tax world and draw borders and assume different tax laws in the different countries. What's going to happen? Well, obviously, with different tax laws in these different jurisdictions, resources are not going to be allocated the same way they are in this hypothetical no-tax world. And because resources in no tax world were allocated based on economic efficiency, the mere fact that you would have a different set of allocation in a multi-border world with different tax systems, they then argue, aha, this is proof that different tax systems are economically inefficient. Now, what? You know, are you serious? And they are. And when I go and talk to these academics, which I sometimes get off to these pointy-headed academic conferences, what I say to them, okay, I understand that. And I understand that on the blackboard, this theory makes sense. But in the real world, don't you admit that high tax rates have what economists call deadweight loss? And if you have tax competition and that brings down tax rates, shouldn't you factor in the significant reduction in deadweight loss? And then match that up against the supposed theoretical economic efficiency losses of resources being allocated differently. And they go, that's an interesting point.
Well, they can limit the flow of capital.
So ultimately what I think is going on is that, as embarrassing as it is for me to say as an economist, there are some very left-wing economists out there. And the whole theory of capital export neutrality, and if you read the OECD and European Commission literature, you will find this nonsense all throughout the technical details. Some economists genuinely, or at least for reasons of self-interest, think this theory of capital export neutrality makes sense. And therefore, they argue that you have to, at the end of the day, and this is why I'm warning, don't do A because then they'll ask for B. Well, Z is this capital export neutrality world. Because what capital export neutrality inevitably leads you to is one tax policy that is identical for the entire world. Same tax rate, same personal tax rate, same corporate tax rate, same capital gains tax rate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That is ultimately where this theory brings you. And if you look at all the economists who have consulted for the OECD on this, Hugh Ault, Ruben Avillona, They all write these things. They all believe these things. And that is where the OECD ultimately wants to bring the world.
That will freeze the possibility of poor countries to become richer in the future.
Yeah, which, of course, is one of the hypocrisies about this. America became rich when we had no income tax and government was less than 10% of GDP. France and Germany became rich when they had no income tax and France and government spending was only about 10% of GDP. I actually have a paper with this great chart showing government spending as a share of GDP in all these high-tax European countries. They basically became rich countries when they had very minimal governments and very, very low taxes and zero income taxes. And now they're saying to the Bahamas, sorry, guys, too late for you. Because now we want you to have a tax system that if we had in the 1800s would have prevented us from becoming rich. But the door is closed. And one of the most offensive things is somebody who makes it and then wants to pull the ladder up so nobody else can make it as well. And that, again, is one of the...
Warren Buffett and Bill Gates.
Yeah. Well, once you're rich, you can figure out how to work the system. And you can work the system so that other people can't become rich, too. And that, I think, is offensive. Rick.
Sorry. And I'm not an economist, but I have this theory that I'm scared to death for our government to figure out that they can move to value-added tax or sales tax or income tax. Because I rather like our structure where you pay duty, so that when you raise that duty, it increases the price of that product so much that your citizens rail against the increase in duty, or they should in theory. Where when they get income tax or VAT, they can increase that 1%, and it really doesn't show that much.
Well, a great example of how you're not off the wall is Hong Kong. They have a flat tax, but one thing that's really fascinating about their flat tax, there's no withholding. When you have no withholding, what does that mean? It means that you have to write a tax, in the case of Hong Kong, twice a year. You have to write a check for your tax. It's like writing a check for your mortgage or your rent or your utility bill. Whereas when you have withholding, like I have, I mean, most Americans actually look forward to April 15th because they send a form to the government and they get a check back. And of course, all that means is that the government stole more money than they actually needed to all throughout the year and you gave an interest-free loan to the government. So I agree with you. I want taxes to be low, but I also want them to be very, very visible. Now, in theory, if you replace a consumption tax like an import duty with a consumption tax like a VAT, and you can somehow figure out how to do it so that you make sure the government doesn't get more money at the end of the day, I don't see that as being economically negative. There might be what economists call public choice impacts, though, of the politicians figuring out ways to make taxes less visible and therefore easier to raise. Yes, back there. You are preaching to the choir. I think it is offensive economically, morally, and politically for a big country to try to bully a small country. Well, here's the problem. Here's the problem. You are a small country.
Develop all of their warfare under sea warfare, without paying us one penny. Today they want to come against us because we're a tax-free jurisdiction. This is what creates animosity against democracies, because we're democratic here. Why should we then have to be subservient because of what we've given to them? I'm not an American, believe me.
I fully agree.
We are a democratic, free society, tax-free, offshore jurisdiction, and they should not be able to control our move forward in the free world of free taxation. For their people or the EU people.
All right, well, I give that same argument. I agree, but let me tell you what happens when I gave that. I give that same speech, perhaps not as eloquently. I give that same speech about fiscal sovereignty when I'm off in Europe fighting against these people. And here's what they say: you can have your own tax laws. Now, ultimately, at the end of the day, I don't think they mean that, but they say you can have your own tax laws. We just want to make sure we can enforce our tax laws. And so if our people are investing in your jurisdiction, it's your job to forget your own domestic laws and enforce U.S. or European tax law. Well, what I then say to the Europeans, and this is, I think, fairly effective because I've never had a good response to it. I say, especially when I'm in a place like France or Germany, I say, well, you know what? The European Union has a policy. You will not help the United States investigate, prosecute, or extradite somebody who might face the death penalty in America. You have explicitly chosen that you are not going to help America enforce American law with an American citizen. So why on earth do you think that you have the right to tell the Bahamas to enforce European law with Europeans who want to save and invest in the Bahamas? Countries have always, throughout history, chosen whether or not it is in their self-interest to enforce the laws of other nations. When I'm dealing with American politicians, I tell them, we had a lot of Tiananmen Square protesters come to America after the Chinese army massacred the people in Tiananmen Square. Did we help the Chinese government investigate and prosecute and then extradite those people back to China to be killed for the crime of believing in freedom? No. We choose all the time what nation's laws to help enforce, even when dealing with their own citizens. It's not just whether an American was in Tiananmen Square. It's all about nations always having a policy of choosing what laws of other countries to enforce. And unfortunately, in this situation, the countries that are interested in extraterritorial enforcement and forcing other jurisdictions to become vassal enforcers happen to be the countries with the biggest power, the biggest guns, and the biggest might. And this is purely a case of might makes right. We teach our children that we should do what's right and wrong, and might doesn't make right. But on the international stage, the OECD anti-tax competition effort is all driven by, we're big enough, we can force you to bend to our will. And unfortunately, it's bending to will with bad policy from an economic perspective, bad policy from a moral perspective, and bad policy from a geopolitical perspective. So next time I go to Europe, I'm going to want you to come with me and give that speech. But you know what? They're going to tell you the same thing that they tell me. We don't care. Yes, sir. Well, I'm a tax guy, so I oftentimes love to say that taxes are the only thing that matters. But in reality, there's all sorts of factors that matter in an economy. If you look at the Economic Freedom of the World Index published by Fraser that you're going to be going down to their conference, or you look at the Index of Economic Freedom published by my old employers at the Heritage Foundation, you'll find a common thread. And the common thread is that if you have good monetary policy, good labor policy, good fiscal policy, good tax policy, good trade, et cetera. There are all these different factors that go into making an economy successful. I think Ireland's corporate tax rate is a huge success story. They went from a 50% corporate tax rate all the way down to 12.5%. And they also reduced other tax rates. They reduced the burden of government spending from 52% of GDP to less than 35% of GDP. It's been incredibly successful. But there are other factors in there as well. And Ireland does have a very good policy of developing human capital. In other words, your economy depends on physical capital, human capital, mixed together. And yes, they have a very good educational system. In the past, when they were a high-tax welfare state, their people emigrated. Now the Irish are returning because the economic opportunity in a low-tax economy is so strong. So yes, human capital matters, but Ireland had human capital even when they were a high-tax welfare state, and the human capital moved. It's only after you add it to the mix, better fiscal policy, that Ireland's human capital could be properly exploited to create more prosperity for the Irish people. So you have to have all of everything. Or I suppose you don't have to have all of everything, but you need to have at least enough of all the various good things. And, interestingly enough, you have to make sure you don't make one of several key mistakes. Look at Iceland. Iceland has a very good policy in many respects, but they screwed up their monetary and financial policy. In effect, the three banks in the countries became hedge funds that all took exactly the same high-risk positions. And so it doesn't matter that Iceland has so many good policies, has great human capital. They did so many things right, but they did that one thing wrong, and their economy has just, it's like all of a sudden you have an engine running and you pour a bunch of pebbles into the engine. It just ground to a halt. And it's going to be a big challenge for Iceland to get back on track. So Zimbabwe is another example. You have bad monetary policy, you can destroy an economy overnight. Bad monetary policy played a role, I think, in bringing the Nazis to the power in Germany. You know, so some things, here's the way I describe it. This is, I'm going far afield, so I'll make this short. Some policies are like the foundation of a house. Rule of law, property rights, and sound money are like the foundation. You can have the prettiest house in the world. You can have low tax rates, you can have very modest levels of regulation, low levels of government spending, et cetera, et cetera. You can have a pretty house, but if you don't have a foundation of sound money, rule of law, and property rights, that house is not going to stand very long. And likewise, if you have a good foundation, you can have an ugly shack on it. And I think this is an example of, say, the Nordic countries. The Nordic countries have government that's far too big, but the economies are stable because the foundation is right. So all the factors, I think, are important. I always talk about taxes, but I have to admit, other things like rule of law and property rights may be even more important than taxes. Well, and that just underscores that if the OECD is successful in bullying the Bahamas to surrender its offshore industry, the consequences can really be negative for the Bahamian economy. So let's just hope that doesn't happen.
What do you think we should do about the financial crisis?
Well, I don't know how the financial crisis has affected the Bahamas, other than just the general systemic reduction in the value of financial assets around the world. The one area where it is directly connected to your long-term well-being is Sarkozy and others are trying to say the financial crisis is evidence that tax havens have to be shut down. But that just plays back into the whole issue of what is your best and most successful strategy for fending off these attacks from Europe. Well, in the U.S., I've actually, for the last couple of months, been forced to pretend to be a financial expert because we don't have a financial services person at Cato. So it seems like every day I was going on CNBC or something like that, talking about the issue, praying that somebody wasn't going to ask me what a credit default swap was, because I would have to admit I wouldn't know it if it jumped up and bit me in the rear end. But one thing, you know, from reading the people who actually are experts on this, as I said before, this was a homegrown crisis, a bad monetary policy, bad and corrupt subsidies for housing from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and these so-called affordable lending initiatives that lured people into homes they couldn't afford. combined with, you know, because I don't want to let the private sector off the hook, a lot of people on Wall Street tried to ride the bubble too far and too long, and which to me underscores why there shouldn't be a bailout, because in the marketplace, the people who make mistakes shouldn't be bailed out. They should suffer the consequences. So what it's going to mean for the U.S., I think the Bush administration did the wrong thing. To the extent that any public money should have been involved, it should have been involved in the same way that it was during the S&L crisis 20 years ago, where if one institution's $1 billion in the hole, you maybe pay a healthy institution $1 billion to absorb them. But that way, the shareholders who didn't do their job and the executives who didn't do their jobs, they're out. And unfortunately, we're saying, no, you didn't do your job. We're going to give you some money from the taxpayers instead. So where this ultimately winds up, I don't know, because now we have auto companies, insurance companies, everyone is lining up to try to stick their snouts into the public trough in America. And I mean, I am scared to death of where this ultimately might lead, where we're going to have the government, in effect, subsidizing every industry in the country. Yeah, back there. Well, things are never as bad as they appear, and things are never as good as they appear. So right now, I've all year long, with Bush having been such a disaster, and everybody thinking, okay, the Democrats are going to take over, all year long, I've been dealing with and talking to people from the low-tax world who call me up or email, well, what's going to happen if Hillary gets elected? Or then they switch and they say, what if Obama gets elected? Is this going to mean the end of the world? And I tell them, it's not going to be the end of the world, but it's going to make your life a lot harder. Because I don't know how far and how fast the OECD and the European Commission will make progress on their agenda, but they'll make some progress. But you're right. In every country, there are people who, the wealthy people tend to have the ear of government. Now, oftentimes, they're wealthy because they're just mooching off the government through contracts and stuff like that, so they don't really care about the offshore world. In some sense, their wealth is tied up with government having more power. But you know, there will be pressure, just like with the European Savings Tax Directive. Let's say they get a European Directive Part 2. Will that be airtight? Will it cover every jurisdiction? Will it cover every possible financial instrument? No, it probably won't. So then there'll be, 5 years from now, a fight over the European Union Savings Tax Directive Part 3. So it's not as if the world ever just comes to an end on year 3, month 4, day 16. It's more that it's a constant battle where the other side is going to try to make incremental progress after incremental progress after incremental progress. And as that happens, it begins to cut off the various options for people who are trying to preserve their money from government that is either venal, incompetent, or greedy. And that's going to mean it's easier for governments to maintain bad tax policy. So at the end of the day, your prediction is probably as good as mine about where it all leads to. But I know as of right now, there's going to be a second offensive against jurisdictions like the Bahamas. And I just hope that we can resist it as well as possible. With that, thank you very much for being so patient.
Thank you so much, Dan. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Sidney Sweeting for the vote of thanks.
Mr. Mitchell, like Rick, I'm not an economist, but I did learn a lot of things tonight, and I'm sure those people who know a lot more about it really picked up a lot on what you were saying. But when you were talking about Bahamas, you said what we have to do as far as the offshore banking and so on is all we have to do is stall. Well, we should be all right if that's just the only thing we have to do, because the Bahamas government is very good at that. We can stall on anything you bring up. So, but you obviously very knowledgeable about this, and we wish you could stay here online and talk to us. But on behalf of the NASA Institute and everyone here tonight, we'd like to really thank you for taking the time and come out and speaking to us. Thank you very much.
We do have a very nice book for Dr. Mitchell, but I forgot to get it. My apologies. But we want to thank you. I also forgot to mention Leandra Sfakas, one of our directors, is not able to make it tonight. But Joan really wanted me to express. I know that she would have been over the moon with Dan tonight with her usual exuberance, and we really miss her. And
partying with Joan. There will be a book and a projector.
That exactly, that's for sure. Yeah, there would have been a projector for sure.
No, but by the way, I do have some copies of the book on this whole tax competition issue that I wrote with my colleague at Cato. So if anybody has $22 that they want to spare, Cato, I don't get any a penny of it. Oppressive anti-capitalist place that the Cato Institute is. But here it is for only $22 if anybody wants one. They always insist we bring them to places.
And thank you very much for coming, everybody. We really appreciate it. And Dr. Mitchell's agreed to talk casually if you'd like to stick around for a while. So thank you so much.